You don't understand. And I can't explain. Oh, please, Frederick, let me find my own way through this. He shrugged. What do you think, Jim?
She's mad. Best leave her be in case it's catching.
All right, but Sally, will you promise always to let me know what you're going to do and where you are? If you're determined to thrust yourself into danger, I want to know about it. All right. I promise. Well, that's something anyway. Jim, what are you going to do today?
Dunno. Hang about and annoy people, I expect.
Do you want to see how to set up the camera and take a photograph?
Yes, please. Come on, then.
They went into the studio and left Sally to herself. She turned to the newspaper, intending to look at the financial news, but her eye was caught by a headline. She started to read, and within a minute she was on her feet, white and trembling. Mysterious attack on clergyman. Oxford Brothers in Murder Mystery. An extraordinary series of events took place in Oxford on Saturday last, culminating in the murder of the brother of a local clergyman. The murdered man, Mr. Matthew Bedwell, was staying with his twin brother, the Reverend Nicholas Bedwell, curate of St. John's Summertown. The events began with a vicious and unprovoked attack on the Reverend Bedwell as he visited an elderly parishioner. Entering the lane which led to the invalid's cottage, the curate was set upon by a well-built man wielding a dagger. Despite injuries to his arms and face, the Reverend Bedwell managed to fight off the assailant, who promptly vanished. Mr. Bedwell repaired to a doctor, but meanwhile a message had arrived at the vicarage requesting his brother to meet him by the river in Port Meadow nearby. Thus lured out, Mr. Matthew Bedwell left the vicarage at 3 o'clock and was never again seen alive. Shortly after 7 in the evening, a waterman found his body in the river. His throat had been cut. The victim of this desperate murder was a sailor and had recently returned from a voyage to the East Indies. He and his brother were identical twins, and it is thought that this fact may explain the earlier attack upon the Reverend Bedwell. But the circumstances remain obscure. Sally put down the paper and ran to find Frederick. They wrote at once to Nicholas Bedwell and spent the rest of the day working quietly. No one had much to say, not even Jim. Rosa left for the theatre earlier than usual. Jim had made himself so useful that they asked him to stay for supper. He went out with Trembler and Adelaide to the Duke of Cumberland, the public house around the corner, for some beer to have with the meal. Sally was cooking. They were going to have kedgeree, which was one of the only two things she knew how to cook. Frederick had just come in from the laboratory, and Sally was preparing to lay the table when the kitchen door flew open and Jim ran in.
"Mrs. Holland!" he gasped, out of breath. "She's got Adelaide! She was hiding round the corner. She grabbed her and jumped into a cab. We couldn't stop her."
"Where's Trembler?" said Frederick, dropping the knives and forks and reaching for his coat.
"The big man knocked him down," said Jim. "It was dark. We was just coming round the corner there by the pub where it's in shadow. We couldn't see nothing. She suddenly come out the alley and grabbed her, and Trembler dropped the beer and grabbed her other arm, and the big bloke took a swing at him and flattened him. He's still there as far as I know. I saw him shove her into a cab, and it set off at a hell of a lick."
"Sally, stay here," said Frederick. "Don't go out. Don't answer the door. Don't let anyone in."
"But,"
she cried too late, for he had gone, and Jim had gone with him.
"But what about Trembler?"
she said to the empty kitchen. She looked at the steaming kedgeree, just ready to be eaten, and felt tears of frustration come to her eyes. "Why should I stay here?" she thought angrily. "Isn't it my affair?" She flung herself into the big chair and chewed her lip. What she might have done next she didn't know, but there was a rattle as the door handle turned, and she looked up, startled to see Trembler, shaking and white-faced and bleeding from a cut on the cheek. She jumped up and helped him in, and sat him in the armchair. "What happened?" she said. "Jim came running and said Mrs. Holland had..."
"They got her! The bastards!" he said.
He was earning his name now, shaking more than her at her worst.
"They grabbed hold of her, poor little scrat, and snatched her up into a bloody cab, and I couldn't even stop them. That big bugger hit me, and I fell over. I tried, miss, God's truth, I tried, but he was so big!"
"Fred and Jim have gone out after them," she said, wringing out a cloth and holding it to his face. "They'll get her, don't you worry. Fred won't let anything happen to her. She'll be safe back here within an hour."
"God, miss, I hope you're right. It's my fault. I didn't ought to have let her come. She's a lovely little thing.
Hush, don't blame yourself. Of course it wasn't your fault. It wasn't anyone's. Look, supper's ready and there's no one to eat it but us. Are you going to have some?
I don't know if I can. I ain't hungry any more.
Nor was Sally. But she made him have some, and ate some herself. Neither spoke until they had finished. Then he pushed his plate away and said,
"Very tasty. Very nice."
It had only taken them 5 minutes to eat. "How's your cheek?" she said. His eye was closing.
"Bloody useless I am,"
he muttered as she dabbed at it gently with a damp piece of flannel.
"Can't do anything right."
"Don't be silly," she said. "This place would fall to pieces without you, and you know it. So stop feeling sorry for yourself." She put down the flannel and suddenly found herself in the grip of an idea. She had to sit down. She had begun to tremble.
"What is it?"
said the little man. "Trembler, will you do something for me?"
"What?"
She didn't know how to put it. "Trembler, you know what happened when I went to the opium den with Fred."
"Yes, you told us." "Why? You ain't planning on going there again?"
"No, I don't have to. I've got some opium here. When Mr. Bedwell asked me to get some, I put a bit aside. I knew I'd have to go through it again. I've been stealing myself. I won't know what Mrs. Holland is after unless I do. I'll have to bring on my nightmare, you see. I was going to put it off and put it off and hope she just went away, but she hasn't. And it's all coming to a head, and I want to do it now. Will you stay with me?"
"What? You're going to smoke the stuff here?"
"It's the only way I'll ever find the truth. Please, Trembler, will you stay here and look after me?" He swallowed hard.
"Course I will, miss. But supposing it goes wrong, what'll I do?"
"I don't know. I trust you, Trembler. Just hold me, perhaps."
"All right, miss. I'll do it."
She jumped up and kissed him, and then ran to the cupboard in the corner. The opium was wrapped in a piece of paper behind the Toby jug on the top shelf, and she had to stand on a chair to get it. She had kept a piece about the size of the tip of her little finger, and she had no idea whether that was too much or not enough, nor how to smoke it in the first place, since she didn't have a pipe. She sat at the table and pushed the plates aside. Trembler drew up a chair and sat opposite her, moving the lamp so that it shone clearly on the red oilcloth. The fire was banked up and the kitchen was warm, but to make it more secure she locked the door. Then she unwrapped the opium. "Last time," she said, "I just happened to breathe in the fumes from someone else's pipe. Perhaps there's no need for me to actually smoke it. If I just set light to it and breathe the fumes like I did before, or maybe I ought to make sure. This is all I've got. What do you think?" He shook his head.
"I don't know, miss," he said. "My mum used to give me laudanum for the toothache when I was a boy, but that's all I know about it. They smoke it like tobacco, do they?"
"I don't think so. The people I saw at Madame Chang's were all lying on beds, and a servant was holding the pipe for them and lighting the opium. Perhaps they couldn't hold it for themselves. If I put it on a plate..." She jumped up and brought an enamel plate to the table, and then took the box of matches from the shelf over the fire. "I'll just hold the match to it," she said. "Then if I fall asleep or something, the match will drop on the plate and it won't matter." She took a clean fork and pierced the sticky little ball of resin, and then held it over the plate. "Here goes," she said. She struck a match and held it to the opium. Her hands were perfectly steady, she saw. The flame curled up around the drug, blackening the surface, and then it began to fume and bubble. She leant forward and breathed in deeply, and was instantly overcome with dizziness. She blinked and shook her head and felt sick, and then the match went out. She dropped it on the plate and reached for another.
"All right, miss," said Trembler.
"Could you light the match for me and hold it under the opium?"
"Righto. Are you sure you want to go ahead with it?"
Yes, I've got to. Just keep lighting matches. Keep it smoking. He struck a match and held it in place. She leant forward, resting her arms on the table and pulling back her hair so that it wouldn't catch on the flame, and then breathed in deeply. The smoke tasted sweet, she thought, and bitter at the same time. And then the nightmare began. Wapping, in those days, was very like an island. On one side was the river, and on the other side were the docks and their entrances. To get into Wapping, therefore, you had to cross a bridge, and they were not solid, imposing structures like London Bridge, made of stone or brick, but lighter ones of iron and wood, and they all moved. They were swing bridges, or hydraulic bridges, and from time to time they swung aside or elevated themselves out of the way of the ships moving in and out of the docks. There were seven of these bridges, seven ways in and seven ways out. It was an easy matter to put a man by each of them. There were plenty of people who owed Mrs. Holland favours, and plenty more who were frightened of her. Frederick's cab, with Jim clinging excitedly to the apron, rattled across the swing bridge over Wapping Entrance, the channel that led into the larger of the two London docks. Neither Frederick nor Jim noticed the two men by the winch on the right-hand side.
"Where to, Gov?"
the cabman shouted down. "Stop here," called Frederick. "This'll do. We'll walk the rest." They paid the driver, and the cab turned and drove back the way it had come. Frederick wished that he had more money with him so as to keep the cab there waiting, but he had only just enough to pay for the fare as it was.
"What are we going to do?" said Jim. "I know where her house is. I've been spying."
"I'm not sure," said Frederick. "Let's go and see what's happening." They hurried along Wapping High Street, between the high, dark warehouses and the overhanging gantries and pulleys that swung above them, like the equipment for some multiple execution. After a minute or two, they were at the corner of Hangman's Wharf, and then Frederick held out his hand to stop them. "Wait," he said. He looked round the corner and tugged urgently at Jim's arm.
"Look," he whispered. "Just in time. They're just arriving. She's getting out of the cab, and she's got Adelaide with her." "What are we going to do?" whispered Jim. "Come on. Let's just grab her and run."
Frederick leapt forward, and Jim followed at once. It was only a matter of 20 yards or so to the entrance of Holland's lodgings, and Frederick ran lightly. Mrs. Holland was still fumbling with her keys when he reached her.
"Adelaide!"
he cried, and Mrs. Holland turned in a flash.
"Run! Go with Jim!"
Jim hurtled up, full pelt, and seized Adelaide's hand. He tried to drag her away, but she hung back, paralyzed.
"Come on!"
he cried, and pulled harder, and finally she went. They ran for the corner of the street and vanished, and then Frederick saw why Mrs. Holland had not moved, and why she was smiling at him, for standing right behind him, holding a short stick, was the big man, Jonathan Berry. Frederick looked around, but he was trapped. There was no way out. The corner Jim had turned was not one Adelaide would have chosen. It led them into a blind alley, but she was dazed by panic and went where he pulled her. The place was called Church Court. It was curved, so Jim could not see the closed end, and in any case it was nearly in total darkness. When he got to the end, he stumbled over a heap of refuse, ran his hands up the dark brickwork, and cursed.
"Where are we?" he said. "What's over this wall?"
"A church,"
she whispered.
"Is she coming? Is she coming?"
"The governor will hold her off. Let's get over this bloody wall."
He cast around in the dimness. The wall was not high, 6 feet or so, but it was surmounted by spikes. He could see them in the dim light from the church windows, now that his eyes were accustomed to the gloom. He heard the sound of singing, and wondered whether a church service would be a good place to hide. But they would have to get over the wall first. There was a barrel on its side in a corner. He rolled it to the wall and heaved it upright, and then had to go and shake Adelaide, who was crouched on the ground, whispering to herself.
"Come on, stupid," he said. "Get up here, we've got to climb over the wall."
"I can't,"
she said.
"I'll get up, for God's sake, get up!"
He pulled her up, and made her stand on the barrel. She was trembling like a nervous rabbit, and he went on more gently.
"If we get over here, we can get away and go back to Burton Street. See Trembler. But you got to try,
All right?
He gripped the top of the wall and pulled himself up. The brickwork was thick, so there was plenty of room to stand once he had lifted himself carefully over the spikes. Then he turned and leant over to help her.
"Tuck your skirt up so's it won't catch," he said,
and shakily she did so. Then she reached up and gave him her hands, and he lifted her up. She was hardly any weight at all. Another second, and they were down in the graveyard. Dark leaning stones, rank grass, twisted railings spread out all round them, and the great bulk of the church loomed in front. The organ was playing. It looked warm in there and friendly, and Jim was sorely tempted. They picked their way through the graves and round to the front, where a gaslight on a bracket showed him how filthy they were.
"Put your skirt down now," he said. "You look ridiculous."
She did as he said. He looked to left and right. The street was empty.
"Best not go back the same way, I reckon," he went on. "It's only a step from her place, that bridge. Can we get through these bloody docks any other way?"
"By the tobacco dock, there's a bridge," she whispered. "Up old Gravel Lane."
"Come on in, you show me the way. Keep in a shadow, though."
She led him around the front of the church, and then off to the right, past a disused workhouse. These streets were narrower than the high street, and edged with small terraced cottages rather than wharves and warehouses. There were few people about. They passed a public house, but even that was quiet, although lights blazed behind the streaming windows. They walked quickly onwards, and Jim's hopes rose. They'd have to walk back to Burton Street, but that didn't matter. An hour and a half's trudging wouldn't hurt. It had gone very well, all things considered. They paused at the corner of Old Gravel Lane, which was wider and better lit than the little street they were turning out of. It was starting to rain. Jim squinted ahead, his hand over his eyes, and saw the bulk of two or three tall warehouses at the end of the street, and then a bridge.
"Is that it?"
he said.
"Yes,"
she said.
"That's the tobacco dock."
Carefully they went around the corner and set off towards the bridge. A cart trundled past with a tarpaulin spread over the load, but it was gone before Jim could call to the driver and beg a lift. One or two passers-by looked curiously at the pair of them, the frightened little girl in a cloak too big for her, and the boy without coat or hat on this wet night, but most went on their way, heads down against the weather. They were almost at the bridge before they were spotted. There was a night watchman's hut on the right-hand side of the road, in front of which a fire was glowing in a brazier, hissing and spitting at the occasional raindrop which eluded the canvas awning hung roughly above it. A man, two men, sat in the hut, and out of the corner of his eye Jim saw them stand when he and Adelaide were approaching, and he just had time to think, "What are they doing that for?" when he heard one of them say,
"Come on, that's her, that's the one."
He felt Adelaide shrink away beside him, paralysed again. He grabbed her hand as the men came out of the hut, and they turned and shot back the way they'd come. There were no side turnings. The walls of the warehouses rose sheer and dark on either side.
"Run, for God's sake! Run, Adelaide!" he cried.
He saw an opening on the left and flung himself into it, dragging her after him, and then round a left-hand corner and then a right until the men were out of sight.
"Where to?"
he said, panting.
"Come on, quick, I can hear them."
"Shadwell way,"
she gasped.
"Oh, Jim, they're going to kill me. I'm going to die, Jim."
"Shut up and don't be stupid. They ain't going to kill you. No one's going to kill you. She only said that to frighten you, the ugly old bitch. She wants Sally, not you. Come on, how do we get to Shadwell?"
They were in a little place called Pearl Street, hardly wider than an alley. She looked to left and right indecisively.
"There they are,"
came a cry from behind them, and pounding footsteps echoed from the walls. Once again they fled, but Adelaide was tiring, and Jim was short of breath. Another corner, and another, and another, and still those heavy footsteps followed them. In desperation, Jim flung himself down a little court so narrow he could hardly squeeze through, thrusting Adelaide ahead of him. She tripped, he fell on top of her and gasped, and lay still. Something moved in the passage ahead of them, a quick, scuttling sound like a rat. Adelaide flinched and pressed her face into his neck.
"Hello, matey," came a voice from the darkness.
Jim looked up. A match flared, and then Jim felt his face grinning for him, of its own accord.
Thank God, he said. Adelaide, it's all right. This is me mate Paddy.
Adelaide had no breath left to speak with, and she was at such an extremity of fear that she could hardly move. She looked up and saw the face of a dirty, foxy boy of about Jim's age, clad apparently in sacking. She could say nothing, so she lowered her head again onto the wet stone.
"Mr. Gill, what Mrs. Holland wants," he said.
"You heard, have you?" said Jim. "We got to get out of Wapping, but she's got blokes on the bridges."
"You come to the right fella," said the boy. "I knows everything hereabouts. Everything there is to know, I knows it."
Paddy was the leader of a gang of mudlarks. He had made Jim's acquaintance when he and his pals had made the mistake of first stoning him, and then meeting his answering fusillade with insults. Jim's aim was better, and his vocabulary was far richer than anything they could muster, and he earned their respect at once.
"But what are you doing up this way?"
whispered Jim.
"I thought you never left the riverbank."
"Plans, matey. I got me eye on a collier in the old basin. Lucky for you, eh? Can you swim?"
"No. Can you swim, Adelaide?"
She shook her head. She was still lying prone, her face to the wall. The passage they were in was roofed over, so they were out of the rain which was beating heavily on the street behind them. But a chilly stream was running down the passage from the gutter and soaking Adelaide's dress. Barefoot Paddy took no notice.
"Tide's on a turn," he said. "Let's be going."
"Come on,"
said Jim, tugging Adelaide up. They followed Paddy further into the passage, feeling their way in the darkness.
"Where's this?"
whispered Jim.
"Animal charcoal works," came the reply from ahead. "There's a door just up here."
He stopped. Jim heard a key turning in a lock, and then the door creaked open. The room they entered was cavernous and long, and the guttering flame of a candle lit only a corner of it. A dozen or more children, clad in rags, lay asleep on piles of sacking, while a wild-eyed girl a little older than Paddy held the candle. A foul, thick smell filled the air.
"Evening, Alice," said Paddy. "Two visitors."
She stared at them, silent. Adelaide clung to Jim, who stared back, not at all abashed.
"We've got to get him out of Wapping," said Paddy. "Is Dermot on a barge?"
Alice shook her head.
"Send Charlie along to tell him, then. You know what I mean?"
She nodded at a small boy who left at once.
"Do you live here?" said Jim.
"Aye. We keeps the rats down for rent and sells them to the Fox and Goose for ratting."
Jim looked around and saw a pile of animal bones in a corner with something stirring on them. The something pounced and became a boy of 5 or 6, nearly naked, who tottered to Alice with a squirming, lashing rat in his hands. She took it without a word and thrust it into a cage.
"You can stay here if you like," said Paddy. "Handsome doss, this." "Nah, we gotta move. Come on, Adelaide."
Jim tugged her hand. He was worried. She was so passive, so still. He'd have liked to see a bit of fight in her.
"This way, then,"
said Paddy, and led them through into an even larger, even fouler-smelling room.
"Gotta be careful here. We ain't supposed to have a key. They keeps the furnaces going all night, so there's a watchman somewhere."
They passed through a succession of rooms and passages, pausing occasionally to listen for footsteps, but hearing none. Eventually they reached a cellar, in one corner of which was the bottom of a chute, down which bones and horns and hooves were evidently tipped. It was slippery with fat and rancid with dried blood.
"How are we supposed to get up that?" said Jim.
"What's the matter with it?" said Paddy. "Tasty."
He gave his candle to Adelaide and showed them how to climb the chute by bracing themselves against the sides. Jim took the candle and shoved Adelaide up, taking no notice of her protests, and after a minute they stood at the top in the fresh air and the rain. They were in a cobbled yard with a wire fence, opening onto an alley behind a public house. Paddy tiptoed to the fence and looked through.
"All clear," he said.
Obstacles did not seem to exist for him. The wire fence looked solid and fixed, but he knew a spot where a staple had come out of the post and where it could be lifted aside. He held it for the other two and they stepped through swiftly.
"Fox and Goose Yard," said Paddy. "The landlord here has our rats, what we catch. We've got to get across Wapping Wall now, and then we're at the river. It's only a short step."
Wapping Wall was a street, not a wall, and took only a moment to cross. and almost opposite them was the entrance to King James's Stairs. Jim could see a tangle of masts and rigging, and a gleam of water.
"We can get hold of a skiff down there," said Paddy. "Easy, row your home. You go down, I'll keep an eye open up here."
Jim and Adelaide moved down the dark passage between the buildings and found themselves on a narrow little wharf. Beneath them vessels lay sideways on the mud, ropes ran up from them to bollards on the wharf, and the flight of stone steps led straight down onto the foreshore.
"Where do we go, Paddy?"
said Jim, and turned, and then stopped. Mrs. Holland stood in the entrance. Paddy stood beside her. Jim reached for Adelaide and put his arms around her, his mind racing. He could find only one word to say, and he said it to Paddy.
"Why?"
"Money, mate," was the reply. "Gotta live."
"There's a good boy," said Mrs. Holland.
"I'll be back," said Jim. "I'll be back, and I'll find ya."
"You do that," said Paddy, pocketing the coin Mrs. Holland gave him. Then he vanished.
"Well, now," said Mrs. Holland. "Seems like I've got you, you little bitch. You can't run away now, 'cause Mr. Berry's down there at the bottom of the steps, and he'll twist your head off. He does that with chickens to keep his hand in. They runs around flapping their wings for a good 5 minutes after their heads is off. I made a little bet with him on how long you'd run about for, and he's awful keen to win it, so I wouldn't go down there if I was you. You're caught now, Adelaide. I gotcha."
Jim could feel the child making little convulsive movements as he held her.
"What do you want her for?" he said.
And then he felt cold because Mrs. Holland looked directly at him for the first time, and he knew that she really was capable of having a child's head pulled off to see if she'd run about. She was capable of anything.
"I want to punish her for running away. I want all kinds of things out of that child. Yes, come on up, Mr. Berry."
Jim turned and saw the big man climbing the steps. The little light there was didn't reach his face, so he seemed to have no face at all, to be all shapeless malevolence. Adelaide pressed herself into Jim's side, and he looked around desperately for a way of escape, but there was none.
"It's Miss Lockhart you want, not Adelaide," he said. "You want Sir Ruby, don't you? Well, Adelaide don't bloody know where it is. Let her go."
The only light on the sodden waterfront was the dim gleam from a distant window, but for a second, another light seemed to shine out of Mrs. Holland's eyes as she looked past Jim at Mr. Berry. Jim turned and saw the big man raising his stick. He pushed Adelaide behind him.
"You try it, mate,"
he said, staring up at Mr. Berry with all the daring he possessed. The stick crashed down. Jim raised his arm and caught the whole force of it on his elbow. He nearly fainted. He heard Adelaide cry out and saw the stick raised again, and then he lowered his head and charged. Mr. Berry brushed him aside like a fly and dealt him another blow with the terrible stick, on the shoulder this time. Jim fell into waves of pain and hardly knew he had fallen. He tasted blood and heard a child's cry. He knew he had to help her. That was why he'd come. He forced his head round and found he couldn't get up. His arms wouldn't obey him. He struggled against the pain and found himself crying to his deep shame and disgust. Adelaide was clinging to him, to his jacket, to his hand, to his hair. She was gripping him tight and he couldn't lift his arms to help her. Mr. Berry was holding her around the neck with one hand and tearing her loose from Jim with the other. She was choking, her eyes were rolling, she was gasping. The big man was growling like a bear. His lips were drawn back from his broken teeth. His red eyes glowed closer and closer. He had her loose. He lifted her higher.
"Put her down," said Frederick Garland. "Put her down at once, or I'll kill you."
Mr. Berry stood still. Jim wrenched his head round. Frederick was standing limply, one hand against the wall. His face was terribly marked. An eye was closed, his mouth was swollen, one cheek was blackened and cut, and he was shaking all over. Mrs. Holland stood and watched, comfortably.
"How?" said Mr. Berry.
Put her down and find out, said Frederick.
I thought I sorted you out, said Mr. Berry.
You're losing your touch, Mr. Berry, said Mrs. Holland. Mind you, he's a game chicken, this one. That makes four times now he's crossed my path. I want him dead, Mr. Berry. Give me the girl.
Adelaide was as limp as a doll. Mr. Berry dropped her, and Mrs. Holland seized her at once.
He'll kill you, Fred, croaked Jim.
No, he won't, said Frederick thickly. Then Mr. Berry ran at him, and Frederick dodged. Never, never, Jim thought, he'll never live. But he's brave, though. Frederick took a blow to the head and fell, but twisted out of reach of Mr. Berry's boots. He ain't got his stick, thought Jim. He must have dropped it to pick Adelaide up. And then Frederick reached the wall and pushed sideways, sweeping his leg around to bring the big man down. He fell like a tree, and Frederick was on him at once, pummeling and punching and gouging and twisting. But he was so slight and so weakened that his blows were like those of a child. Mr. Berry brought up an arm like an oak beam and swept Frederick aside. Jim struggled frantically to get up and put his weight on the damaged arm for a moment, only to find it collapsing the wrong way under him. He crumpled at once into such a blaze of pain as he had never imagined. His head struck something loose as he fell, the stick, he thought, and fainted. Another second, and he was awake again, to find Frederick on his knees a yard away, shielding himself from a barrage of blows that thundered down on his shoulders and head. He struck out in reply, and missed with three blows for every one that landed, but he was so weak now that his punches would hardly have hurt Adelaide. Jim twisted and reached out with his good arm till it found the stick. I'm going to die of this pain, he thought. I can't bear it. But look at Fred, he won't stop. Nothing will stop him. He's like me, he is. He's a good'un. Here, Fred, he said, and thrust the stick at him. Frederick felt it in his hands before Mr. Berry saw what was happening, and the feel of it seemed to give him strength. He put both hands round it and jabbed it forward into the big man's stomach. Mr. Berry gasped. And Frederick did it again, and scrambled to his feet. They were a yard or so from the edge of the wharf. Frederick knew this was his last chance. Some ghostly remnant of his fencing came back, and he balanced himself and lashed forward. He could hardly see. Both eyes were filled with blood, but he felt the stick connect and heard Jim's cry, "This way! This way, Fred!" He struck again and wiped his eyes. Jim hurled himself at the big man's knees, and tangled, Mr. Berry fell, just at the edge of the wharf. Frederick struck again. Mr. Berry raised himself to his knees and swung his fist at Jim, catching him on the ear. Jim fell, but the big man was off balance. Frederick saw his chance, and with the last of his strength swung the stick. Mr. Berry disappeared. Jim was lying still. Frederick fell to his knees and was sick. Jim pulled himself to the edge and looked over. There was silence.
"Where is he?"
said Frederick through thick lips and broken teeth.
"Down there,"
said Jim. Frederick crawled to the edge. There was a stone platform, a yard or so wide, at the foot of the jetty. Mr. Berry lay sprawled half across this and half across the mud. His neck was broken.
"You done it,"
said Jim.
"We done it. We killed him."
"Where's Adelaide?" They looked around. The wharf was empty. The rain had stopped, and the puddles gleamed in the dim light. Below them on the mud, the lowest boats were stirring and slowly righting themselves, as if they were rising from their graves. But it was only the tide coming in. Jim and Frederick were alone. Adelaide had gone. London Bridge. Much later, Sally awoke. The hands of the kitchen clock had advanced to midnight, and the fire had burned low. Trembler was asleep in the armchair. Everything was familiar, except herself, for she had changed, and so the world had changed. She could hardly believe what had happened,
except that it explained everything. Trembler woke up with a start.
Good God, miss! What's the time?
Midnight.
Have you... Oh, no. I didn't fall asleep, did I?
She nodded. It doesn't matter.
You all right, miss? I'm awful sorry.
No, I'm fine.
You look proper shocked, as if you've seen a ghost. Let me make you a cup of tea. And I said I'd stay awake. Fat lot of good I am.
Sally wasn't listening. Trembler got up and touched her shoulder.
Miss?
I've got to find the rupee. I've got to have it. She stood up and moved to the window, looking distracted, beating her hands together gently. Trembler stood away, alarmed, and gnawed his moustache. Then he spoke again.
Miss, wait till Mr. Frederick gets back.
There was a rattle at the door. Trembler sprang to unlock it, and a moment later Rosa was in the kitchen, cold and wet and cross.
What on earth have you got the door locked for? Oh, what a night! And the house less than half full, and a miserable bunch they were. Sally, what's the matter? What is it? What's that smell?
She wrinkled her wet nose and brushed the water out of her eyes as she looked around and saw the ash and the matches on the table. What's this? Not opium. Trembler came back before Sally could speak.
It was my fault, Miss Rosa, he said quickly. I let her do it.
And what's happened to you? She dropped her cloak on the floor and hurried to look at his bruised eye and cheek.
What in the world has been going on? Where's Fred?
Adelaide's gone, said Trembler. Mrs. Holland's come with some great bruiser and snatched her in the street. Mr. Fred and that young Jim went after him.
When?
Well, hours back.
Oh, my God. Sally, why the opium?
I had to. Now I've got to find the ruby because I know all about it. Oh, Rosa, I'm... Her voice shook, and she put her arms around Rosa and broke into a sudden sobbing. Rosa embraced her and sat her down gently.
What is it, love? What's the trouble?
Her cold, wet hands soothed Sally's cheeks. In a moment or so, Sally shook her head and sat up straight, wiping away the tears with rough fingers.
I've got to find that ruby. That's the only way I'll ever finish this business off. I've got to work it out.
Wait there, said Rosa. She ran upstairs and was back in under a minute. She dropped something on the table, something heavy, wrapped in a handkerchief, something that glinted in the linen folds.
I don't believe it, said Trembler.
Sally looked at her in pure astonishment.
It was Jim, Rosa explained. He... You know these stories he's always reading. I suppose he thinks like a sensational novelist. He worked it out some time ago. It was in a pub in Swale Ness, apparently. I can't remember the details, but he kept it away from you because he thought there was a curse on it, and he didn't want you hurt. Do you know what he thinks of you, Sally? He worships you. But he brought it to me today because he thought I'd know what to do. He told me the whole story just before I left for the theatre, so I didn't have time to tell you earlier on. It's Jim you've got to thank. Anyway, there it is.
Sally reached out and opened the handkerchief. In the centre of the crumpled whiteness was a dome of blood, a stone the size of the top joint of a man's thumb, containing all the redness in the world. It seemed to draw in the light of the nearby lamp and magnify it, and change it, and cast it out again as visible heat. And inside, it was that shimmering, drugged landscape of caverns, ravines, abysses, which had so mesmerized Major Marchbanks. Sally felt her head swim and her eyelids droop. Then she closed her hand around it. It was hard and small and cold. She stood up. Trembler, she said. Take a cab now. And go to Hangman's Wharf. Tell Mrs. Holland that I have the ruby, and I will meet her in the middle of London Bridge in an hour's time. That's all.
But I'll give you the money. Do it, Trembler. You fell asleep while I was in my nightmare. Please do this.
A spasm crossed her face as she said this,
as if she hated reminding him of his failure. He bowed his head and shuffled into his greatcoat. Rosa jumped up.
"Sally, you can't. You mustn't. What are you thinking of?"
"I can't explain now, Rosa, but I will soon. And you'll see I've got to meet her. But please, Rosa, trust me. This is the most important thing, the only thing. You can't understand. I couldn't understand myself. Before..." She indicated the ashes of the opium and shuddered. "At least let me come with you," said Rosa. "You can't go alone. Tell me on the way."
"No, I want to meet her alone."
"Trembler, you're not to come there yourself. Just send her." He looked up guiltily, and then nodded and left. Rosa went on.
"I'll let you go onto the bridge alone, but I'm coming as far as there with you. I think you're crazy, Sally."
"You don't know..." Sally began, but shook her head.
"All right, thank you, but you promised to let me meet her alone. You've got to promise not to interfere, whatever happens."
Rosa nodded.
"All right," she said. "I'm starving. I'm going to eat a sandwich on the way."
She cut a slice of bread from the loaf on the sideboard and spread it thickly with butter and jam.
"Ready for anything," she said. "And sopping wet. You're mad. You're insane. A lunatic. Come on. It's a long walk."
Sally heard the city clocks chiming the half hour. 1:30. She walked slowly back and forth, ignoring the occasional pedestrian and the even more occasional cab or four-wheeler. Once a policeman stopped and asked if she was all right, evidently thinking that here was another of those poor wretches who took to the river as the answer to all their sorrows. But she smiled and reassured him, and he walked on steadily. 1/4 hour passed. A cab rolled up to the rank at the northern end of the bridge, but no one got out. The driver hunched his coat up around his shoulders and dozed, waiting for a passenger. The river moved beneath her. She watched the tide flowing in, lifting the boats tied up at both banks, with their riding lights glowing. Once she heard the chugging of a police steam launch moving down from Southwark Bridge. She watched it come and disappear beneath her feet, and then walked across to see it come out the other side, and go down slowly past the dark bulk of the tower, and curve off towards the right. She wondered if that thickly clustered shore on the left was Wapping, and if so, which of those black wharves backed onto Holland's lodgings. Time passed. She got colder. The clocks chimed again. And then a figure appeared under the gas lamp at the northern end of the bridge, a squat, dumpy figure in black. Sally straightened, and a yawn died away in her throat. She stood in the middle of the pavement, clear of the parapet, so as to be seen, and in a moment the figure began to move towards her. It was Mrs. Holland. Sally could see her clearly. Even at this distance, the old woman's eyes seemed to glitter. She moved in and out of alternate shadow and light, limping a little, wheezing, holding her side, but never stopping. She came to within 3 yards of Sally and stopped. The ancient crooked bonnet she wore obscured the top part of her face so that only her mouth and chin could be seen clearly, her mouth working all the time as if she were chewing something small and resistant, but still the eyes glittered in the darkness.
"Well, dear," she said at last.
"You killed my father."
Mrs. Holland's mouth opened a little, exposing the great sheet of teeth. A pointed, leathery tongue crawled slowly across them and withdrew.
"Well," she said, "you can't make accusations of that kind, missy."
"I know all about it. I know that Major Marchbanks was my father."
"He was, wasn't he?" Silence from Mrs. Holland.
"And he sold me, didn't he? He sold me to Captain Lockhart, the man I thought, the man I knew as my father. He sold me for the ruby." Mrs. Holland was perfectly still, perfectly silent. "Because the Maharaja gave the ruby to my...
to Captain Lockhart as payment for protecting him during the mutiny. That's right, isn't it? Slowly the old woman nodded. Because the rebels thought he was helping the British, and my fa- and Captain Lockhart left Major Marchbanks guarding the Maharaja in the dark somewhere.
The residency cellars, said Mrs. Holland. With the women, some of them, and the children, some of them.
And Major Marchbanks had been smoking opium, and he was afraid and ran away, and they killed the Maharaja, and when he came back with Captain Lockhart, they quarrelled. Major Marchbanks begged for the ruby. He had debts, and he couldn't pay them.
The opium. Pitiful. It was opium as killed him.
You killed him.
Now, now. I want that ruby, miss. That's what I come for. I got a right to it.
You can have it. When you tell me the rest of the truth.
How do I know you got it?
For answer, Sally took the handkerchief out of her bag and set it on the parapet under the gaslight. She unwrapped the ruby so that it sat red on white in the very centre of the broad stone ledge. Mrs. Holland took an involuntary step towards it. One more step and it goes over, said Sally. The truth. I know enough now to be able to tell if you're lying. I want it all. Mrs. Holland faced her again.
All right, she said. You got it right. They come back and find the Maharaja dead, and Lockhart knocked Marchbanks down for a coward. Then he heard the child crying. You, that was. Marchbanks's wife had died. Sickly thing. Lockhart says, is this poor child going to grow up with a coward for a father? A coward and an opium smoker? Take the ruby, he says. Take it and be damned, but give me the child.
She stopped. Sally heard the heavy tread of the policeman returning. Neither of the women moved. The ruby lay on the parapet in plain view. The policeman stopped.
All right, ladies?
Yes, thank you, said Sally.
Nasty night to be out. Gonna have more rain, I shouldn't wonder.
Wouldn't be surprised, said Mrs. Holland.
I should get off indoors if I was you. I wouldn't be out myself if I didn't have to be, eh? Well, back to the beat.
He touched his helmet and walked on. Go on, said Sally.
So Marchbanks snatches the child, that's you, from the cradle, and gives it to Lockhart. It was the opium and the debts working in his mind, and he pockets the ruby and... That's all.
No, it isn't. What did Captain Lockhart's wife say?
Wife? He never had a wife, he was a bachelor.
And that was Sally's mother, gone. Wiped away at a stroke. And it was almost the worst blow of all. To know that that wonderful woman had never existed. Sally said shakily, But I've got a scar on my arm, a bullet.
That was no bullet. That was a knife. The same knife as killed the Maharaja, rot his soul. I was going to kill you, only there was disturbed.
Sally felt faint. Well, go on, she said. What about you? How do you come into it? Don't forget, I know some of it, and if you don't tell the truth... She took hold of the corner of the handkerchief. It was a lie. She had no idea of how Mrs. Holland was involved, but from the old woman's gasp as Sally reached for the ruby, Sally knew she would get the truth.
It was me husband, she said hoarsely. Horatio. He was a soldier in the regiment, and he got wind of it.
How? Said Sally, and pushed the stone closer to the edge.
He was down there,
said Mrs. Holland swiftly, her hands twisting round each other in her anxiety.
He saw it and heard it, and later on, back home...
You blackmailed him. Major Marchbanks, my real father, you robbed him of everything, didn't you?
He was ashamed, bitter ashamed. Of course he didn't want no one to hear about what he'd done. Sell his own child for a jewel. Dreadful.
But why did you hate my...
Captain Lockhart, what had he done to you? Why do you want to kill me?
Mrs. Holland wrenched her eyes away from the ruby.
He reduced my ratio to private soldier, she said. He was a sergeant. I was proud of that. To be a private again, that was cruel.
Her voice shook with the injustice of it.
But why do you say the ruby is yours if the Maharaja gave it to Captain Lockhart and he gave it to Major Marchbanks? What right have you got to it?
I got the best right of any of you. He promised it to me yourself 20 years before, the lying bastard. He promised it.
Who? My father?
No, the Maharaja.
What? Why? Whatever for?
He was in love with me.
Sally laughed. The idea was preposterous. The old woman was making it up. But Mrs. Holland shook her fist in fury and hissed,
It's true! So help me God, I made a bargain with you, missy, the truth for the ruby, and this is God's own truth. You look at me now, and you think I'm old and ugly, but 20 years before the mutiny, before I married, I was the loveliest lass in all of northern India. Pretty Molly Edwards, they used to call me. My father was a company farrier in Agrapur, only a humble civilian, but they all came to pay their respects, the officers, make eyes at me. Not only the officers, neither. The Maharaja himself fell for me. Damn him. You know what he wanted? He were crazy with love for me. And I tossed me head at him, head full of dark curls. You think you're pretty? You're a washed-out, mournful thing beside the girl I was. You're nothing, you are. You never compare. Well, the Maharaja promised me the ruby. So I gave in. And then he laughed and threw me out the palace, and I never saw the ruby again till the night in the residency cellars.
It was you who saw everything then, not your husband.
What's the matter now? Yes, I saw it all. More than that, I let in the men who killed him. And I laughed as he died.
She smiled at the memory. Sally could see nothing of the beauty she claimed to have had. There was nothing left at all, nothing but age and cruelty. And yet Sally believed her, and felt sorry. Until she remembered Major Marchbanks, and his strange, timid gentleness the day they had met, the way he had looked at the girl who was his daughter. No, she did not feel sorry. So she took the ruby in her hand. And is that all the truth?
All that matters. Come on, it's mine. Mine before you, before your father, before Lockhart. I was bought with that stone, same as you. The pair of us, each bought for a ruby. Now give it to me.
I don't want it, said Sally. It brought nothing but death and unhappiness. My father meant me to have it and not you, but I don't want it. I give up all my claim to it. And if you want it, she held it up, you can go and get it. And she threw it over the parapet. Mrs. Holland stood perfectly still. They both heard the faint splash far below as the stone hit the water. And then Mrs. Holland went mad. First she laughed and tossed her head like a young girl and patted it with satisfaction as if there were not a filthy old bonnet there but a mass of dark, glossy curls. Then she said,
My beauty, my pretty Molly, you shall have a ruby for your lovely arms, for your blue eyes, for your red lips.
Then her teeth fell out. She took no notice, but her speech became incoherent, and her bonnet fell crookedly, obscuring half her face. She thrust Sally aside and scrambled up onto the parapet. She tottered wildly for a moment. Sally, horrified, put out a hand but felt only the empty air as the old woman plunged. She fell without a cry. Sally put her hands over her ears. She felt, rather than heard, the impact. Mrs. Holland was dead. Sally sank to her knees and cried. and at the northern end of the bridge, the driver of the cab flicked his whip gently and shook the reins, and the cab began to move. It came at a walk along the roadway and stopped beside her. She was still sobbing. She looked up through a mist of tears. The driver's face was hidden, the occupant, if there was one, invisible. The door opened. A hand rested on it. A large, sunburnt hand, with fair hairs on the back and knuckles. A voice she had never heard before said, "Please get into the cab, Miss Lockhart. We have something to discuss." She stood up, speechless. She still shook from time to time with sobs, but that was automatic. She was now devastated with astonishment. "Who are you?" she managed to say. "I have many names. I recently visited Oxford under the name of Elliot. The other day I had an appointment with Mr. Selby, and the name I used then was Todd. In the East, I am sometimes known as Ah Ling. But my real name is Hendrik van Eden." "Into the cab, Miss Lockhart." Helplessly she obeyed. He shut the door, and the cab moved away. The East India Docks. Sally held her bag tightly on her lap. Inside it, loaded, was the gun she had bought for the enemy she could not see. And here he was. She felt the cab turn right as it left the bridge and moved down Lower Thames Street towards the tower. She sat trembling in a corner, hardly able to breathe for fear. The man said nothing and did not move. She could feel his eyes on her, and her skin crawled. The cab turned left and began to move through a maze of smaller streets which were less well lit. "Where are we going?" she said shakily. "To the East India Docks," he said. "And then you may come further, or you may stay." His voice was soft and cracked. He spoke without trace of any accent, but he shaped each word carefully, as if he were remembering how to say it. "I don't understand," she said. He smiled. She could see his face dimly in the inconstant light from the gas lamps they passed. It was broad and genial, but his eyes, glistening darkly, traversed her slowly from head to toe. She felt as if he were touching her, and shrank away into the corner and shut her eyes. The cab turned right into Commercial Road. He lit a cheroot and filled the cab with smoke. It made her feel sick and dizzy. "Please," she said. "May I open a window?" "I beg your pardon," he said. "How thoughtless of me." He unfastened the window on his side and threw out the cheroot. Sally slipped her hand into the bag as he did so, but he had turned back before she had found the gun. Neither of them spoke. The only sound was the trundling of the wheels on the road and the clop of the horse's hooves. Several minutes passed. She looked out of the window. They were passing the limehouse basin of the Regent's Canal, and she saw the masts of ships and the gleam of a night watchman's fire. And then they were past and turning into the East India Dock Road. Somewhere in the night, not far from here, was Madame Chang. Would she help if Sally could get to her? But she would never remember the way. Her hand crept, little by little, further into the bag and closer to the gun. And her heart sank, for it had been raining hard during her walk to London Bridge, and the bag was soaked. "Please, let the powder be dry." 10 more minutes passed in silence, and the cab turned into a narrow street bounded by a factory on one side and a high wall on the other. The only light came from a single gas lamp at the corner of the street. The cab pulled into the pavement and stopped, and Van Eden leaned out of the window and gave some money to the driver. Without a word, the driver got down and unharnessed the horse. Sally felt the cab rock as he climbed down, and heard the jingle of the harness, and felt the little jolt as the shafts were laid on the ground.